You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Joining up to the Comedians Comedian Podcast Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders makes you feel special and cool, and it's easy to set up. It's even easy to cancel. And if you have any difficulties, you can email me directly and I personally walk you through it. So you can listen to all the extra content in a very simple way. Once it's set up, all the extras just ping onto your device without needing you to do anything else. You know, like a private podcast. So this is a little extra treat for everyone who supports the show. If you're swamped with podcasts or pushed for time, you can still support the podcast. Just sign up anyway, ignore all the extras, and get a hassle-free, warm, fuzzy feeling that lasts forever. Don't miss out. Become an insider at comedianscomedian.com/insiders.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the only podcast about comedy. Today I'm talking to Robin Ince. Now, as you might expect, Robin makes 5 points per minute. He's absolutely everything I hoped he would be. This is a colossal conversation we had, so there's a lot of stuff to enjoy here. We're going to talk about Robin's development. We're going to talk about his process. We're going to open with a lot of stuff about Robin's forthcoming book, which I cannot recommend enough that you get your teeth into as soon as it is released, which I believe happens later this year. You don't need me to tell you to buy it. I'm sure you're all rabid Robin Ince fans, so let's hear from the man himself. This is Robin Ince. Let's begin with hypervigilance.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because I'm about 150 pages into the draft of your book. I'm sorry I didn't finish it.
Oh, no. Do you know what? I literally only said I was not expecting you to read it. It was there partly because I went, oh, thank heavens, I've actually finished the bloody thing.
It's absolutely brilliant. I've been whetting the appetite of I say that, maybe it all goes terribly wrong on the 151st page.
Do you know what? It's been one of the hardest things that I've ever done. I've really working out, it was about 200,000 words the first draft. Because I love writing and I hate editing, so I love just going. I think that's a very common stand-up thing, isn't it? It's just there and then it's gone.
Yep.
And the trouble with the book was like that is they go, yeah, this makes no sense. It does in my mind,
all
of that stuff.
Sure.
Sorry, yes,
it's a really good book, and I am often sent things by people who I'm going to interview, and sometimes I read all of them, and sometimes I read a bit of them and then go, I'll go back to that. I will genuinely finish this book.
Because nice,
and I think anyone listening to not just this podcast with you in it, anyone whose concerns are the concerns of my podcast is going to absolutely love your book. Can you just describe what it is for the... It's not released yet, is it?
It comes out in October. And the basic idea of it is... It started off when... originally, in fact, the whole of the introduction was all about the night that Robin Williams, the announcement of his death. And I happened to be doing a gig with Eddie Pepitone. Mm-hmm. And what was it called? Cheaper Than Therapy.
Yep.
And it was comedians talking about how comedy might be their therapy or whatever. Normally it was just doing a stand-up set. Mm-hmm. And I happened to say to the guys running it, look, Eddie's here and I've been doing it. Why don't we have a chat afterwards? Why don't we have a little bit more of a chat? And so both of us did our sets and then we came off for the interval and then everyone looked at their phones and went, and it was people in shock because turned out Robin Williams had just been announced that he'd killed himself. And I got really... I made a little documentary for Radio 4, and I get very frustrated when people kind of separate comedians as if we become very special things, that we are not like other human beings. And, of course, what we are is we may... I mean, the book is basically meant to... It came from my original idea that comedians are... They're the same as everyone else, but they are exaggerated human beings very often. Is we exaggerate ourselves on stage, mm-hmm. and sometimes off stage, that can mean that the highs become exaggerated. I remember talking to Joe Brand about the idea that at times it's a sense of self-imposed bipolar. And I would like to make it clear, in no way do I mean that in a way to demean people who genuinely suffer from sure. bipolar disorder. But you kind of create this scenario where you're on your own for the whole day and you're in a weird town and you're all very much inside yourself. And then you go out for 2 hours and go, look at me, here are all the things in my head. And then you go back to your hotel or your bed and breakfast and suddenly you're alone again. And so you're...
Yes.
And I wanted to use that to hopefully within it, as well as explaining why we may become as we become and how you can use... There's a hard, I don't know if you've got to it yet because I can't even remember the order of the chapters anymore, but things like inner voices, I'm fascinated by the fact that... As a comedian, one of the things you can do is many of the inner voices that may well be detrimental, you can turn into something you express on stage.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm reading in the chapter I'm reading at the moment, you're talking about how you enjoy asking comics to describe, to actually visualise yeah. their inner voice, which is an incredible, just what a lens through which to look at the mind of a comedian. How do you see the you that talks to you inside you? How would you describe your inner voice?
Well, I've got lots. And it's an interesting thing is when you actually realise your inner voice has no accent, but maybe many different personalities. That's my personal one is there's no... and that's what I find intriguing, is you can't... You can hear an inner voice, but it's not the same as hearing from outside. So I have about 3 or 4, okay. I think. On stage, I would say it's... You know, there are moments where you get properly lost in the moment of creativity. And that's I think, one of the reasons that I love doing stand-up, is when it is all working. Like, there was a gig I did on Saturday in Southampton, and the night before, I hadn't been happy with the gig. And that night, I just thought, yeah, this was probably erratic. This was probably... I didn't know what was coming next. And for those 2 hours, all there was a cacophony, but there was also silence, if you see what I mean. As I think Eddie Peppertone calls his negative voices, his... I think he calls them pig voices, yeah. You know. And... So I normally have there's one that's creating, there's one that's judging, and there's also an editor who said, don't say that. So it's a little kind of panel of Muppets, really.
I'm going to push you to visualise them. What do they look like? Because I understand those elements, but one of the most fascinating things in that question that you challenge other comics with is what do they... Just visualise them. Is it... I think Neil Edmund was talking about how his is a bar out the front of his house with... out the front of his head, his house. I know from my own, I've done some gestalt psychotherapy, and I have got a clear kind of like, oh, there's that one, and that one, and they have identities and they have faces. What do yours actually look like? Or is it for you simply a sort of a tone of voice or an attitude rather than a visualizable thing?
The nearest I can say is that there's the incredible painter Walter Sickert, who was for a while considered to be a possible Jack the Ripper. It's the one who, I've forgotten her name now, the American crime writer who actually bought one of his paintings and cut it all up. And there's these incredible paintings that of the Bedford, in fact, in Balham,
oh,
and various other areas where it's kind of Victorian-like music hall paintings. And they do seem to me to be like little half-finished faces in a painting.
Okay.
So it has almost has a kind of the quality of a horror film where you look at what should be a still painting and every now and again you realise the face has moved. So it's that kind of thing. They're not in sharp focus, but they're popping up around the place.
Very nice.
And they're in a dull lit... Probably from the work of Powell and Pressburger, they're also... It's very red, very red. There's a lot of faded velvet in there.
Okay. So you're... Let me think. Let's just by way of an introduction. I mean, there won't be many people listening to this who don't know who you are. I think one of the things I wanted to preface this interview with is that I become very panicky when I don't feel I've sufficiently researched someone. You are impossible to do sufficient research on because there is so much Robin Ince out there in so many different media and different, you know, I mean, you have been involved with... I probably first saw you in Book Club.
Yeah, that was
12
fun.
Or 13 years ago, maybe even before I was a comic, so maybe around that sort of time. And I asked on the Facebook group for this podcast, questions please for Robin Ince. It had the most questions that a request like that has ever had. And a lot of them, some of them were excellent questions, which we'll get to. A lot of them were references to in-joke upon in-joke upon in-joke. Right. I just went, I don't know what any of these things mean, because it kind of, it formed this sort of chrysalis of like the internet community's idea of who you are. Do you think you...
Terrifying.
It is!
It's terrifying. That's the thing. I was talking with another comedian today and we were saying, you know, what previously might have, at the worst, have been an overheard conversation when you're sat in a toilet and two blokes go to the urinals and talk about how shit the previous act was. That is now this incredible magnified notice board and sometimes like a great big, you know, H.P. Lovecraft leather-bound book of, you know, individual hatred. You know, it's a really... And a lot of positive things as well. I mean, that's... But of course, we're programmed to notice the negative. But yeah, the amount of things out there and the amount of possibilities of what people think we might be doing and might be saying.
And you, in your this is necessarily how this conversation will function. I will try to juggle as many of these ideas as possible in the book, which we I'm just going to put in parentheses is a sort of study of what makes a comedian, and it's also an exploration of certain ideas of psychology in relation to what makes a comedian, and it's also sort of a memoir.
Yeah.
You talk about your hypervigilance, you talk about this editing voice. I don't know if that is the same as the editor voice, but your constant awareness of yourself. And that's something that I personally really identify with, and perhaps many comedians will, but something that particularly piqued my interest was that you partially attribute yours to PTSD from a car accident you had when you were a child. That you draw a line between...
Well, it's...
you know, you ask the question, might that have been responsible for the hypervigilance? Yeah. I was involved in a car accident when I was a child. My therapist believes that I might have some PTSD from it. A very small, just trauma, you know, what we used to call trauma. He always says, what we used to call trauma. and as a result... I also ask the question of myself, Jesus, I wonder if that's where my hypervigilance is coming from. Always worrying about how one is being perceived, how will this be taken, how, you know, a sort of immediate... There are some people, I imagine, if a thing falls over outside or you hear a bang, everyone will have a different reaction to it. I think you and me both, possibly from what I've read of your work, what I've seen of your work, I think we are of that type whose hypervigilance will mean that if we hear a bang outside, we will immediately think, something's gone catastrophically wrong. Is it my fault?
Yeah.
What's, do you know what I mean? Those sorts of things, that's our immediate reaction to something. So So with that all being the groundwork, is the fact that an online kind of simulacrum of you exists in the minds of people who are aware of your work, what is the relationship between that and your hypervigilance? Like, if people are constantly reflecting back to you, almost kind of fulfilling the prophecy of you going, oh, people are, you know, I've always got to watch out for what I say. People are constantly actually watching out for what you say. What the hell's all that about, Robin?
It is a really intriguing... How old were you when you were in the car accident?
11.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the things that I found fascinating when I started looking back at it. And as, you know, it's that thing, you know, life lived forward and understood backwards, is the further away you get from an event, the more... Because when I was writing the book, I got really worried because one of the editors actually said to me, because they ended up needing two editors, they went, "This, oh, my God, what have you done to us?" And you are allowed... to say, so you don't have to just brush up. And then I was in a car accident that I thought was my fault. My mum's in a coma and blah, 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 blah. And they went, no, that is a big one. When you're 3 years old or 11 years old, whatever, these are major events. And I was very worried in the process of writing it as well, that at no point did I want people to think I was going sad me or anything like that. I wanted to just go, right, I'm just talking about these things, just to be out in the open. And I don't want, you know, because there are people, you look at the level of suffering and I think we're always a bit embarrassed, especially, I think, you know, well, maybe not especially British people, but there is that thing where you go, oh, well, this thing happened and it may well have had a major effect on me. Blah, 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 blah. So, but I do think it's like my sisters who were, my other sister who was in the crash would have been 7, and I think my other sister would have been 10, and we all had very different reactions to what happened. My 10-year-old sister wasn't in the crash, but afterwards, and the way that my dad managed to deal with what was going on. But I do think that, yeah, that bit, that the first reaction to a phone ringing at any time now, at any time is, oh dear, what's happened?
Yeah.
Even watching Nick Cave on, in fact, it was before Nick Cave on, Courtney Barnett on Sunday, I was watching, beautiful, and there were just clouds in the background, and I just briefly imagined what would happen if suddenly an atom bomb went off, and I saw Courtney Barnett eviscerated. And so all of those, you know, the moment of hearing of an ambulance anywhere near my son's school,
this is nice. Brackets, dot, dot, dot. Do you know what I mean? Well, that's like, yeah.
The terrible fear that should you say, oh, I'm feeling very well, then you know that 2 days later, you go, do you know the funny thing? Robin was saying how well he felt, but it just went straight through his body and he was dead within 36 hours. So, yeah, I think some of that, what can become amusingly dark pessimism and the relentlessness of the presumption of not, it doesn't necessarily make you a pessimistic, because I think you, as a performer as well, I think there's a tremendous optimism in what you do. And I think in more and more in the shows that I do, I try to go, if anything, it's that 2 hours a day where I can just go, isn't it amazing to be in the universe and it's an incredible thing to be this rare thing, so blah, 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 blah. And it allows you to create, perhaps from all the negative things, you go, this, the antimatter of that,
yeah,
also allows the matter of going here for 2 hours is a very positive vision.
That's a great
thought. And
I think,
you know, that there are those parts. And that's part of, I think, what I was trying to work out as well, which is I do worry that for some people who I know who've had bad things happen in their life, that they end up still holding on to it. And I think there's that the way, and it becomes a definition, every time something bad happens, they go, well, of course it was because of this. But I think there is, hopefully for some people anyway, a way in which you can basically go, oh, I'm able to understand myself, but I'm able to also not entirely define myself by the negative incidents of my existence. So I go, yeah, you can understand. It's like that thing where people, in a different way, when people get worried about going, oh, I suppose I have to feel guilty about that. And you say, no, be aware. But it doesn't mean awareness doesn't also mean you have to remain tied to it, or you have to feel guilty about it, whatever it might be.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
But yeah, the hypervigilance I find fascinating, that bit of not being able to go anywhere without constantly imagining, even though you are predominantly, I'm certain all of us, being utterly ignored by the passers-by, but that sensation of, oh my God, what does that person think? What does that person think? You know, yes. There's John Dowie in his... Have you interviewed John Dowie?
I haven't, no. He's approached me, actually, and he's got a fascinating backstory, and it's just a case of, for a lot of the time, I want to see someone's material first. And, you know, when is there time to do or read or see anything? I mean, you're the wrong person to ask.
Freewheeling John Dowie, his book is great. But just the way he describes that moment of, even as a man, you know, in his 60s, when you just see that there's a bench of teenage girls and you go, oh, you know, that fear that he's never got rid of, the fact that, you know, and then one of them laughs, and they may not be laughing at him, but he goes, oh, yet again, they go, have you seen the old man with the bicycle over there?
Sure.
And I think it's an interesting, you know, all of these things are ways of, I think if we're fortunate enough, we can go, well, there is some creative way of using these. And I don't know if it helps or not. I don't know. The thing that I've never really got to the bottom of, is it better to be able to go, right, these, and this is what I imagine, this is part of the thing that happened when I was reading a lot of the articles about Robin Williams, is where they kind of try and make it out that it was his stand-up comedy that created this, you know, self-defining, you know, mythological death, you know, which there is, in another way, the fact that every single night he had the chance to go on and go, look at me, may have actually, you know, and also, by the way, I should make it very clear that there was, as you know, there were many things that were going on in his life. He was extremely ill and suffering from something which created delusions and a tremendous amount of uncertainty, which is something totally separate from his life as a stand-up comedian. But, you know, I sometimes think that, if anything, it's strange how rare it is that comedians actually kill themselves.
Yes.
When you think of the fact that, you know, one of the things that people hate most is public speaking and public shame. And every single one of us, and, you know, if anyone's ever been on this podcast and said that they've never died on their ass, then they are lying tremendously. You know, that moment of dying and you go back and you're in a cheap hotel room and you lie there and you go, oh, and you feel desperate, but then you get up the next day and you go to Peterborough, you know. And it continues.
I would love it if specifically Peterborough.
It's Peterborough.
Someone listening to this in the future is like, that's how they keep going. Yeah, that's the solution. So I think you were on the cusp of saying something about, in terms of Robin Williams' death, people love to kind of, is the word archetypalize probably isn't a thing, but do you know what I mean? To perceive an archetype, go, the most obvious one, the sad clown, or the fact that he was who he was on stage, killed him somehow, or was part of this sort of torturous existence. And at the same time, maybe what happens with, I don't know, this is a trite thing to say, perhaps comedians who go on to kill themselves would have killed themselves a lot sooner were it not for comedy and the release and the joy and the community and all those things. Mm. Gave them, who knows? So in regard to you, let's go back to the beginning of who you were in comedy. One of the things I know about your early life in comedy is that you did a four-hander called Rubbernecker.
Yeah, you see, that was actually that was about 9 years in.
Was it? What year was that? Because I feel like I saw a poster for it. I've been going to Edinburgh for 25 years.
I think it would have been 2000 or 2001. It was the first series of The Office was out.
Yeah.
And it was an incredible... It was myself, Steve Merchant, Ricky Gervais and Jimmy Carr. And there was a lovely thing, actually, once where about 10 years ago, I think it was Uncut magazine or Word magazine, had an article about Jimmy Carr. And it had a publicity picture from Rubbernecker.
Oh, wow.
And all four of us. And it just said, Jimmy Carr with Ricky Gervais and Steve Merchant. and I thought, not even to be... And unknown,
yeah,
you know, not even literally to have
zero
such
other comedians.
A sense of invisibility in that, and I remember at the time feeling fine about it as well, and that's when I think I started to work out what I really wanted to do, because when I did Rubbernecker would have been the first thing that I suppose I really did was I did So Think You're Funny in 1992, and I got second place in that. That was to Rona Cameron, who at that point was called Rona Campbell. And I had people coming up to me that I'd watched on telly and watched on Saturday Night Live, and people like Kevin Day going, oh, you were great, mate, you should have won. It was like, and in some ways, it may well have been a negative thing, because I then feel that really for the next 8 years, I was thinking about this walking here, you know, it took me a long time to work out what I actually wanted to do. I loved stand-up. I was obsessed with stand-up from a very, very early age. You know, for the first time, you know, I loved comedy anyway because the you know, growing up, Saturday Night was the two Ronnies, and it was Dave Allen, and it was all of those things. And then there was Rick Mayall, and then there was Alexei Sayle, and then it was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. And then I look back and I think, yeah, probably that first 7 years or 8 years was me kind of doing comedy, kind of being a stand-up, but not being myself doing stand-up.
Yes. Doing an impression of what you thought a stand-up
was. Yeah, this is, oh, that looks like that's what a joke's meant to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll do that, you know. And so then when Rubbernecker came along, and at that point, yeah, Ricky was just about to become, you know, The Office was getting its first, you know, the first series of, no, didn't get high viewing figures, but when the repeat was made, suddenly it was like that moment, then it became enormous. And Steve's act is one of my favourite things. It was such a... Did you ever see Steve Merchant's act?
Not his 15 from there. I've seen him do stand-up.
Just this, he would come on and he'd go high status, very high status, straight away. He's got that great voice, the googly eyes, all of that stuff. And he would basically say how great he was. And then it would start to fall apart. And then by the end, he was furious and he would tell everyone, don't watch don't tell anyone you've seen this. I'll tell them you were lying. And then he would just storm off the stage. And then there would be like about 5-6 seconds. And then he would storm back on going, you can't get out that way. And walk straight through the middle. And I would watch it every night. And it was just this beautiful play. It was 15, 16 minutes of a comedian falling apart. But at that point, I'd really gone off stand-up. It was a very weird thing where, with Ricky and Steve, we'd been doing a thing at the Hen and Chickens in North London, just on Islington Corner, Highbury and Islington. And we did a thing which was us mucking around and doing weird sketches. And Jimmy would MC it. And then they went, oh, let's just do a stand-up show. And I was kind of like, I don't think I was doing TV writing and other things. And I really felt that I'd lost whatever it was that made me want to be a stand-up. And I can barely remember the stand-up that I did in that show. And it was really, really difficult. And then not long after that, I then did a show in Edinburgh, which either people really totally got or did not get at all. You know that bit where you go, so some nights you just stand there.
Yep.
And it was the one where I'd end up punching a melon with Vernon Kay's face drawn on it and it would explode. And then I'd sing Mustang Sally. And then it was from that point onwards, I think only over the last 14 years or 15, so actually it is now over half my career, which is an odd thing, then I started to work out what I actually wanted to do. But yeah, so the first bit, up to Rubbernecker, it was on and off, and I was a club comic doing various different clubs, and I never did kind of, you know, I ended up trying to do genres about two or three times, but
okay,
just didn't really work out at all.
What a joy to talk to Robin. He is just so easy to talk to. He's so honest and open and has just got a million thoughts per second. So we're going to hear a lot more of them very soon. You can go, of course, to the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to hear even more from this extraordinary thinker and comedian. And you can go to Robin's... I mean, do I need to advertise anything that Robin's up to? His book, his numerous podcasts, his Radio 4 show. Basically, if you put Robin Ince into Google, it bursts. So do fill your boots with as much stuff as you can, because he's just someone that gives and gives and gives. And a real pleasure to have him on the show. I wanted to point out a couple of things. Thanks, of course, to Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray for the use of their recording space. If you're a comedian or anything. If you're a comedian or like a sketch performer, if you're a comedy performer or even writer or podcaster of some sort, I highly recommend you get in touch with Angel Comedy at the Bill Murray and see what they have to offer you, because they love giving and they love to provide resources. I'm not going to quote if they have a price list or anything like this. I have no idea what they do, but I'm sure if you are or become friends with them or support them, then they'd be more than happy to support you back. They're a really good organisation where a bunch of comedians have got together, bought their own premises, bought the lease, I should say. This is London, after all. No one's that rich. They've bought the lease on their own premises, and they are doing something genuinely exciting and positive for comedy in, let's say, Britain, because there's not just Londoners working there, but it is primarily focused in London. Check those guys out. Now, something really lovely happened, which I'm just going to very quickly talk about, if you'll permit me. I'm always saying, when I used to busk on this show for general one-off donations, which is still possible to pay if you'd like to, I used to say, one of the things I would say, it's an old street performing thing from my dark past, that the people who can afford it pay for the people who can't, which, of course, is absolutely true. It's a way of thinking about it. You know, it's a kind of paradigm that it's nice to think about. You get a nice warm feeling in your tummy if you're someone who supports the show, blah, 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 you know, because it means you're supporting it for someone who can't. Somebody, this is living proof of this concept, a listener who would like to remain anonymous was paying £2 per month to be part of the Insiders Club. Remember, there are other tiers available, but you all get the same stuff. And they were enjoying the private podcast, and they got in touch with me to ask if they could up their donation to pay for someone else's subscription who couldn't afford it. Bam! That's exactly how I want this to work, and not just because I obviously benefit slightly from the income. That is, I really wish I could tell you who this person is. They're not a comedian, as far as I'm aware. I don't recognise their name. They're someone who's been a fan of the show, a supporter of the show for a long time. And I just thought that was such a nice thing that benefits them not at all. And let's talk about this a little bit in the postamble, this thing of doing nice things for people and never telling them. I tried to write material about this for last year's show, and the stuff didn't get into the show. But it's a wonderful thing. We'll cover that in the postamble at the end of this episode. I just wanted to thank that anonymous listener, and I have been in touch with the person who I've bestowed. I haven't bestowed anything. I've facilitated the bestowment of their enormous generosity. So now there is another member of the Insiders Club who I won't name either, because I don't want to. It's not any of our business. But we warmly welcome another person who has been paid for by someone else. Here's a thought. If you're someone who has been supporting the show for a while, and I have honoured your historical £1 a month donation, but I don't mean honoured, do you know what I mean? Not in like an honour way, but I've just, you were paying £1 for a long time. So I said, hey, great, join the Insiders Club. Here's the thing, when I rolled it out. If that might convince you, if you think, yeah, why don't I up it to £3, then you could be paying a £2 thing for someone else and make that clear if you get in touch with me. How's that? Is that good? Does that go against all of the principles? Is it completely in line with all of the principles? I think that's a good thing, and I'm very happy to be a part of that process. That kind of generosity really floats my boat, whilst also benefiting me, obviously, because I won't go into exactly how, and I won't lay it on any thicker than I already am. But broadly speaking, well done, anonymous donor. I am very proud of you, and I hope you're listening to this episode and feeling as smug about yourself as someone of your enormous generosity will allow themselves to feel. That's all on that. The tour is almost finished. God, we've got almost nothing left. If you're in London, come along on the 21st, 22nd and 23rd of June to the Soho Theatre. There are a few tickets still left for Like I Mean It, which is my stand-up show. In London at the Soho Theatre, it is just the 55-minute to an hour show. Bang, that's your lot. If you're in Cardiff, if you're in... Where are the other places left? I think by the time you listen to this, it's just Cardiff. I'm doing Tring as well, the Tring Fringe. I believe that's just an hour as well, like the Soho shows. But in Cardiff, the very last night of the show, I'll be doing a full preview of this year's new stand-up show, End Of, which is going to the Edinburgh Festival and will be situated in the Liquid Rooms warehouse every day of the Fringe from the first Saturday to the final Sunday in August. And it will be... I'm not on the 16th. Sorry, someone's already got in touch to say, we always come and see you on the 16th. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I do need a day off. And I thought I could take a cheeky Thursday off. That'd take everyone by surprise, including people who legitimately would like to see me. Apologies to you, Pear. But if you are going to be at the festival and 2:50pm daily, a lovely afternoon show. You can roll in hungover, or you can be the sort of bright, spark, perky person who's been up watching theatre since 10am. Come along and see that show. It's free, but do bring money. It's at the Liquid Rooms warehouse. It's a 250-seater at 2:50pm to celebrate my 25th year of The Fringe. I'm so excited about this show. Thank you to the people of Edinburgh and in particular Glasgow. At Glasgow Stand, I did the first proper full all the way through bells and whistles preview of End Of, and it was phenomenally good fun. So thank you to everyone, and sorry that the late start time of that show and then the long interval and then me doing a full preview meant that we all staggered out at 11:15 feeling like we'd just been thoroughly dodded. So that's enough of that. One tiny little thing for a sort of mad idea I've had. I'm doing a little thing in Welwyn Garden City, which is not actually open to the public. It's a live podcast, and I spoke to this fabulous theatre group in Welwyn, based around a theatre there, and they are having some sort of weekend of hijinks. And on the Saturday night, I'm going to go along and do a live podcast for them. And I also offered them, why don't we get the guest of my podcast, currently TBC, to come and do a set. So I'll host it. They do like a 20 or a 30 minute set. And then we have an interval. And then I interview them and we can talk about the stuff we've just done and how it went. And I thought, that's a good idea. That's the sort of thing I could offer to you if you have a venue. So I'm specifically targeting theatre groups with this. If you are someone who is in a theatre group in a nice place that's not a bajillion miles away from London or Bristol. If you can get 100 people together, I'll come to effing Stirling. if you think you've got a bunch of people and not exactly a festival, I just thought there must be other opportunities for that. If you're like a theatre group and you like getting to get like a theatre group, like an amateur dramatics group or something similar, some sort of interest in arts, maybe that would be an exciting thing to offer you. That would be, it'd be a lot of fun for me and for whoever the comedian was to do. I could try and find someone local who you might know. I'm pitching an idea which doesn't exist yet. But if you're in an amateur dramatics group and you're having some sort of mini festival of things, I think that'd be quite a good thing. Why not just stick that in your pipe and smoke it? We'll come back to that idea another time. But get in touch, info@comedianscomedian.com, if you think that might appeal. I think that's everything I need to say for now, and I'm probably talking faster than usual in this bit because I'm just, as soon as I think the words Robin Ince, I just start talking faster. I hope anything in this conversation I'm having with him is intelligible, because we're probably both having quite a fun time talking fast with one another. Let's get back to Robin Ince.
You know, I love it when people communicate with me afterwards to say, who was that woman you mentioned who did the work in Pulsars? Oh, I just went to an art gallery. I haven't been to an art gallery for 10 years, but I sure saw your show about art. And I thought, yeah, I should go. All of those things.
Yes. That is, none of those things are presumably why you started comedy. Sorry, that is my question. Yeah.
No, that's the thing is, I did it because I just loved it. I really, you know, my... You know that teenage obsession where there's that sad... It's not a sad moment, because I still get tremendously excited by watching things that are brilliant. Like I said earlier, you know, when I watched Patti Smith, the first time I've actually seen her do a music gig, and I've seen her do poetry before and spoken word, and I just went, look at that. Look at that person who... I don't know what age she is now. Is it 60s, 70s, whatever? She means it. And that now is the thing that I think there was a certain point where the most important thing for me in an artist is... and in anyone, actually, do they mean it? And I find so much of mass media, so much of political commentary, so many things where I go, just doing things to rile people, just doing that needling bit, that lack of passion and empathy and all of those things. And so when I watch someone, I think, if I think, that's a good act, it's an act. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I can't enjoy it all, because it doesn't have to be about, when I mentioned before about Tim Vine, one of my greatest jokes, sometimes at 1 a.m, I think, I've finished my gig, I'm sitting in a hotel room, I've read a book, how shall I end my day? I'll go onto YouTube and I'm going to watch Tim Vine do Pen Behind the Ear. And it's, so that kind of comedy. And also with Tim means it. That's what, here's the beauty of the ridiculousness of, I can't remember what it's called, Geography Hippo or something.
Yeah,
the
hippo. Is it Cartography Hippo?
Flag Hippo.
Flag Hippo.
All of those things. And they're beautiful.
For people who have not listened to every episode of this show and heard the numerous times we talk about Pen Behind the Ear, do yourself a favour and go on YouTube and look up Pen Behind the Ear by Tim Vine. I'm not going to say any more on the subject. Absolutely. So given that is not what you set out to do, but it is absolutely what you relish now, and you have still the bones of a club comic who still wants to keep getting to the laugh, which I think you smile at in a way that are you proud of that? I think you deserve to be proud of that.
I think I just...
That's a hard one thing.
I want it
thing.
To be... I mean, now I'm in that terrifying thing of I've got to write 2 Edinburgh shows and I can find all the information and what I want to talk about, but I can't find the jokes yet. That's
where you are at the moment. This is Edinburgh coming up now.
One all about my love of horror, because when I was 8 years old, I started to get into horror. And I think that will partly be a story about the car crash I was in when I was 3, and partly be a story about Christopher Lee and, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And that one I'm not relaxed about, but I think I reckon I'll be able to turn that into me. Mm-hmm. A show about the nature of time from the perspective of philosophy and physics, and also about quantum behaviour, and also about the Big Bang. I've got about 12,000 words in a document of notes, but I look at it and I go, there's about 15 minutes there so far.
Okay, and those minutes are explaining rather than doing gags.
Now, because I've started doing little bits of poetry as well, because I found it, when I took a break from stand-up, when I came back, I thought I should do things I haven't done before, and I thought I'll try and write some poems or something that changes, because I'm very erratic when I start talking, blah, 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 which I think is why Sophie Scott, who did the Royal Society of Christmas, I had a magnetic pulse to the side of the brain, which stopped me being able to talk. It affects the motor region. I think I was considered to be the hardest person. I did Jabberwocky, so I was there in front of a bunch of school children going, "'Twas brilliant, and the slithy toves did gar, and blah, blah, blah." That was amazing.
Oh, my God. She invented an anti-Robin Ince machine.
Yeah, she's...
that sounds like an X-Men.
If you have a powerful magnet and you go, "When will he shut up?" All you need to do, Stuart, is pull out and place it against the left-hand side of my head.
That is something straight out of the X-Men, where the comedians are mutants and someone has developed the technology to lock them down.
Heckled by Magneto the other day. How did it go? I couldn't get a word out. Blah, 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 blah. But yeah, so it's so I've got some of the that was partly the poetry thing was an idea of me. I thought it's a way of me playing with language, because I love that moment where it was interesting. One of the shows that I did last year in Edinburgh, because I didn't have enough time to do that many previews, I actually wrote it. It's the first time in 25 years that I sat down and wrote a 10,000 word script. And obviously, once I started performing it, it all loosened up. But I think that's why that show, I did 2 shows last year, one which was a stand-up show at the Stand and one which was a comedy show but about art. And I think the comedy show about art was better because it was looser. The other one, because it had started as a written piece, okay. I think it took me, especially once I started touring, almost all of that show is gone. There's only 10 minutes out of 2 hours that is from that show.
If you write it all down longhand, then you're doubling up on work, aren't you? Because you're making it fit the page, and then you've got to make it come off the page.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've only in the last few years, I now write almost exclusively on index cards. So I do like an idea, and then I'll say it on stage, and then listen back to it and go, okay, that's somewhere it went. So under the idea, I'll write one reminder of one of the things. It's a bit hipster.
Well, that's
you can
I've
shuffle
got,
them
I've
and
got
take them out.
Over 2,000 postcards at home. With my last 10 years Edinburgh shows, because they all start. My start of the show is I go and go, oh, look, they've done another lovely collection of penguin covers as postcards, right? So I buy two boxes of those, and every single night, I'm just about to start that process now. In my bag, I have, I haven't got it in this one, I've got a bunch of postcards of, I think it's some furniture design classics that I bought from some bookshop, and that started to have that process on. And it's a good way of doing it in one way. I mean, I think it's half and half, because I think sometimes I think I've got an idea merely because I've written 12 words on a postcard. And you go, every single night what I've done is go, said the 12 words and gone, yeah, I really worked that one out, yeah. And so
I can think of specific cards where I'm exactly in that place at the moment. But that is better than having 1,000 words in a document with no ideas in it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So at least you're closer to the thing itself. I use index cards, and I like to buy the packs of multicoloured index cards. And I think I'm realising now, because on some level it makes me think there's method to it. There isn't. It's random what colour they're on. But I like the idea an audience might go, oh, this is a yellow card.
And it is physicalising your mind as well. It's that bit of going, there is some of my mind. I've put it in that box there, and I can retrieve that when necessary.
And is this where you are at the moment now? We're recording this in, I look at my watch to find out, it's June. We're recording this in early June. Is this normally where you would expect to be pre-Edinburgh? Given the August, for those that don't know, the Edinburgh is the whole month of August, and I always have to remind myself there are people who might not know that. And that is the deadline for most comics working in the UK for the new thing to be ready. So 2 months to go, is this normally where you'd be?
I like to... Now I look back and I go, normally by now I have almost a working show. And then if I really scrutinise my memory, even the one that I did about art last year, I remember doing the first preview I did, and I came off going, I don't have a show. And then by the second preview, it just all clicked in. So I do wake up every single morning and the first thought is, oh, hell, have I got enough? I haven't worked it out. And I'm relying on the fact that for the last 10 years, all my shows have been, a lot of it comes from performing it and busking it and saying, here's a bunch of ideas. And I mean, it was interesting. I remember watching, I was very relieved to see that the Daniel Kitson, when we were out in Oslo, and Josie Long as well, and we were doing a lovely festival there. I don't know if you've done it, the Crap Comedy Festival. They're brilliant.
No.
It's done by the Norwegians of Comedy, who are very funny.
Great
sketch troupe. They're great. And Dan went on, and he was literally in an afternoon slot where it was a total preview, the first time he'd ever said these things. Mm. And you could see he didn't quite have that. You know that bit where you go, if my brain does not immediately, you know, turn to fire at the point of me standing on stage, I'm lost. This is just following. Yeah. And he didn't quite have it. And there was a lovely moment where afterwards, in the evening, he came to see the show that Josie and me were doing. And this guy just stopped him in the corridor of the theatre and he went, I saw your show this afternoon. I have to say, not so good. and Daniel burst out laughing, I think, just because he thought, the fact this guy... And the guy thought, maybe he thinks I'm joking. He goes, no, not so good. And it was a great moment to see that someone who is, I think, correctly considered to be one of the really great ones, that even he starts off by going, it's just a bag of ideas.
Yes.
And I think it's a very exciting thing to do. And every time, you know this... Every time that a show has truly come together, you can never remember that every single one of those ideas was awful at some point. You know that bit that, like, every single one, you had a point where you were standing there, maybe you got it right on the first night, but the second night you tried it again, and because the adrenaline was different, because you have that fascinating thing, where when you first do an idea on stage, sometimes part of your own, here we go, the words for the first time, and you're making it up, and the audience are carried along. They don't realise, but there's something going on. There's some kind of alchemy there. The second night, you kind of know. And then it has died.
Yes.
And then it might take three...
But I've got a map. I know exactly where I'm going. Yeah, yeah.
But yesterday, but the words, they were... And then it can take 5, 6, 10, 20... I mean, like, one of the worst bits of advice I was ever given, and various comics will say this, is if an idea doesn't work, I think it's 5 times, or they might say 4 times, it's not a good idea. And I think that's rubbish. So if a joke doesn't work 5 times, it's never going to work. And you go, no, there's so many variables involved. There's so many possibilities that it doesn't mean... That, you know. And I found there was a joke when I did a show tour about evolution. And there was this thing I had about the fruit of science, was it the apple or the banana? And I had this whole thing which mixed up various different scientific ideas. And I did it 6 nights in a row at different clubs in London trying to work it out, and it never worked. It was the moment where the audience, oh, no. And then the moment I started doing it on tour, it was one of the best moments of the show. But it just took the correct framing, yep, the correct environment. And then once I removed it from the show, I was actually able to do it in stand-up, you know, in benefit gigs and stand-up nights. So it wasn't the fact that it had to be in the show. It was fine.
This is one of the most frustrating things happens after Edinburgh, where you have to do a bit of your Edinburgh show in a club, and so you instinctively make all of the editing decisions you should have made on day one of the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just all the scaffolding falls away. That's the idea. Oh, turns out that 5 minutes was a one-liner.
But that's a very interesting thing, where you... Once you've come up with a punchline, your brain, it's much harder, and there's a book by a guy called Leonard Mlodinow who talks about this issue in terms of ideas of creativity and technology and many other things, which is once you have a solution, it's much harder to find an alternative solution.
Absolutely.
So I remember one of my favourite... I had this routine at the end of one of my shows, which I used to love performing. It was about having gone to see a blockbuster film and all the people leaving afterwards and going, yeah, it was all right, that. And I was like,
Fast and furious.
Like, really angry about it. And I do this whole bit about, you know, that I want to see something which is like having, you know, heroin directly injected into your eyes, like William Blake sitting up a tree with some angels singing Tank Park Salute by Billy Bragg and you know, the Aldous Huxley sitting talking to it, all this whole thing. And then on the final night that I did it, the last gig that I was ever going to do it, I found the punchline that I'd required all the time, which is this huge thing. And then the punchline doesn't work out of context, but it just required the line, blah, 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 3 stars. And that's it. And the 3 stars. And it came to me on the final night. And I went, there it was all the time. It had a punchline, but it had an extra punchline and my brain wouldn't show it to me.
So the idea that you could 3 stars, that throws a whole new light on that routine. It's an excellent routine. And it's really interesting because is that available anywhere, that routine?
Go Faster Strike.
Of course.
The last DVD that I've done with, I will be doing something with them for the one show that I've just done, but that one, which I think it is like my last ever show, as I called it, because it was when I decided that I had to stop doing stand-up for a while, and I knew full well that it was last ever show, .. But
yes,
there was a little bit of me that genuinely imagined when I stopped doing stand-up for a while.
I remember reading your blog as you were going, this is it, I've made the decision.
Yeah, and it was really weird. I was out in Brisbane, and I talk about it a bit in the show, but my wife rang me up and was like really panicked and worried about it. And then I realised her real panic was, oh my God, he's going to be around the house the whole time. Yeah. But it was an interesting period of time because people went, there's no way you'll be able to do it, no way. And actually, I did the odd benefit and occasional like festival gigs, but compared to normally I will be doing 5 to 7 gigs a week. Mm-hmm. Compared to that, it was 3 or 4 a month. And I didn't feel a tremendous sense of loss. And I think that was possibly because I'd done so much that I didn't feel that I had to... It required redefining who I was. It was a bit like, you know, Edinburgh some years. One year I did 4 shows a day and then did other people's shows when they asked me as well. Sometimes I'd be doing 6, 7 shows a day. And so when someone said, oh my God, you're only doing a half run next year. And I went, I did 135 shows this year. I think I'm allowed to do a half run. You know, that bit where you go.
Yeah.
And it was, so when I wrote that part, and it really, I hit this. And it's a very funny, I think I talk about it in the book. I don't know because I can't remember what's been cut out because it was so long. But the strange thing when you look back, when you're going through some kind of, you know, greyness, the grey dog, not the black dog of you know, the full depression, but that moment where you become detached, that moment where drive starts to dwindle, that, you know, the difficulty I had in the tour that I did now 3 years ago, leaving the house was an absolute nightmare. I just had no, and I felt sad apart from the time I was on stage was fine. That was the only time. And that was when I realised there was something that was going wrong. That moment where you go, right, so I'm fine when I'm on stage and I'm fine for that half hour afterwards when I have a chat in the bar with the audience. And then it goes, again. And you know, I was out in Australia, so I'm a long way. I always find Australia quite hard. I've never gone out there and done the festivals. I'm very often either on my own or, you know, sometimes touring with like Brian Cox, whatever. And it was... It really hit me hard in Australia. And I've had a year where everything should have been what 15-year-old me would have gone, this is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and instead I was going, none of this is making me happy. I'm fine when I'm on stage, but the moment I'm fully conscious, not performer conscious,
And that was to do with being away from your family or just to do with
many things. I think it was, you know, that bit ego comes into it, doesn't it? You watch other people's success and you think, why am I getting Attila the Stockbroker? I was doing a gig, the great poet, punk poet Attila the Stockbroker. I was doing his festival Glastonwick on Saturday. And he said, oh, I've kept seeing your, you know, the tweets that you're having trouble selling tickets in Bridgewater. He said, and I was like, oh. And then I thought, hang on a minute, I've made my whole life, and he's been doing punk poetry for 40 years. He said, you know, I've been playing to between 150 and 50 people the whole of my life, and I sit there and I'm in a pub and I get a chance to perform and it's enough. And it was a good moment. It's only a week, but it's a lot of reminder. Mm. But because sometimes I think, well, I've done an arena tour with Brian Cox, you know, we're doing another one, there's 10,000 people a night and they send you lovely feedback. And then when you go and play the Arts Centre, and some of the Arts Centres you haven't quite sold out, some of them you like, you know, Bridgewater was not a big seller. And you feel like, oh, God, is this it? Is this the only people who are going to see me?
I thought you were all up for me. You're only up for me when Brian's there?
Yeah. And I think I've just now come out of that bit of, like, is it enough just that the communication you are having with that smaller number of people is perhaps more potent and more important for, you know, that is it not? And I think I've just got out of it. But it wasn't nearly as bad. I've had a lot of fun doing this tour. It's just that trying to balance everything else and finish books and do all those kind of things. But that time it was just something hit me, something, and I was like, the Australian solo tour was lovely and I was having a nice time and I was meeting, but I was, the head was in this space of just, oh, this has been doing this for 27 years. You know, that bit where you just go, and I don't know what, and rationally you look at it and you go, this is a better life. That look at all the things. You're staying in a nice hotel. Someone's making sure you get to the airport. It's all lovely. And that, and I think it was, if I hadn't taken that break, I think that would have been very bad for me. I think
just exhaustion. That sounds like exhaustion.
I think that's part of what it was. I think it was a mixture of exhaustion and ego and, you know, kind of a toxic narcissism, probably, you know. And then the break was, and it was a good time. It worked out in a bizarre way, what I'm going to say now. It worked out well because it turned out I decided to stop working for a while and my mum got ill and my mum died and it allowed me to be around and just going, right, I'm able to do these things full on at the moment, and I was able to do lots of, and pretty much every weekend I would go off with my son because my wife was doing a course, and we'd go off and we'd have adventures. And it's a very important part, you know, part of the thing before when I was talking about the change in stand-up. I still think, you know, one of the major changes, and I don't know if you've experienced this yet, but there's a certain point where when you have a child, in a really positive way, it can reopen loads of stuff of creativity. Mm-hmm. Some people seem to think it's the death of creativity, but it allows you to go, hang on a minute, why am I doing that piece of shit when I should be doing this? You know,
has changed. A whole different perspective, on life, on comedy, on what's worthwhile, on how, I mean, I'm working, when I first sat down to write, after the first time I sat in the cafe that I sit and write in, the first time after the birth of my son, which was months later, I put a snarky comment on Facebook going, oh, I'm really looking forward to some of this extra focus you apparently get. And I did. Got it. Because there's I was like, I've got 90 minutes now and that's all I'm getting. I've got to fucking not look at Facebook and, you know, to work on it. Not to mention all the huge life perspective, you know, where do you fit on the wheel of time, you know, that you like, oh, I have a child now and that, all of that stuff. Absolutely. I think that's, there'll be a lot of people who are parents and who are creative people and who have been listening to this who have been through that exact same thing of going, oh shit, this is over now, and hopefully are seeing it flourish and a different sort of trend.
It's interesting, some of the things that you also are no longer afraid of expressing on stage. I mean, a few years ago, I stopped getting worried. If I work with people that I really admire their work, I think, fucking tell them. Tell people. There's so many people. If you, you know, and it depends. Sometimes it's scientists, sometimes it's writers. So lots of different groups. And I think, no, oh, I love your work. Oh, will you sign a copy of the book? You know, no embarrassment about that. Even some friends of mine, people who are friends, that, you know, I think express the fact that, and I think it might not be that. It might be age, it might be many different things, but that thing of if you love someone's work or if you appreciate something they've done, don't be scared, because it's so fucking easy to be snippy and cynical and sarcastic, and that bit where you go... So, like, I remember an old Robin Williams routine there. I think Live at the Met ends with him being father and child, and he becomes the child and he puts his hand up and holding the dad's hand and walks off. And, you know, as an 18-year-old, I think I thought, I'm not really sure about that.
Yeah.
And now I think, you know, one of my shows ended with me reciting Oh, the Places You'll Go. Congratulations, there's your day, you're off to a great place, you're off and away with your brains, your head and your feet and shoes. You can steer yourself any direction you choose, you're on your own. And that bit. And I think sometimes you can just go, no, it's fine. This is short. This is brief. And it's such a... The amount, the fog of negativity that can be tapped into now, the easy accessibility of those who heckle you long after you've left the stage via social media, whatever.
And also the fact that the classic problem of our age, which is that on social media, certainly for artists, you constantly see the resonating successes of all of your peers because you're getting their mediated social media presence, which they're needing to do to sell tickets. And you know what I mean? You're in a position of going, oh, maybe I'm not selling so well on a particular tour or in a particular venue, whilst people are constantly blaring their achievements in a way that you oneself do because you have to do because you have to shift tickets.
I deliberately wrote I got quite a snotty review from Chortle for my evening stand-up show in Edinburgh last year. And he might have been right, I don't know. It was an odd room, and maybe the show wasn't particularly good that night, and maybe, I don't know, some of the things that I addressed were not what he wanted to address that particular night. But I wrote about that review because I saw how many people were... You know, you're so bombarded by 4- and 5-star reviews, and I thought, I'm just going to write about that because I think there are so many people who at the moment are just going, oh, Jesus Christ, oh, God, I'm not getting those reviews. So I just thought, just be honest and say, do you know what? I got this and it hit me for a moment. And do you know what was annoying? I don't look at reviews. I avoid reviews. The only reason I saw it was I knew that Michael Legg had a really good review and I wanted to find the address of that, web address of that, so I could plug Michael's show. So in a moment of dumbfounded and stupid altruism, I end up finding my shitty review, all because of Michael Legg. And but yeah, that I think sometimes, without it then becoming a kind of self-congratulatory negativity, that moment of just... Because we look at other people, it's like that moment that you find out the comic that you always thought was the most confident comic in the world. And suddenly, 20 years that you've been working with them, you find out that they've been terrified and that the chutzpah that they... And there's a great thing that Philippa Perry, who lives not far from here, who is a psychotherapist, and I interviewed her in the book. She says, I really find her a very interesting person, and she writes very well. And she said, part of the problem we have as human beings is that we judge everyone else from their outside and ourselves from the inside. So when you're at a party, when you're at whatever you are, you are hearing you go, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And you're seeing that woman or that man across the room going, look at them, look at the chutzpah, look at the joie de vivre. And you don't, and then you think, hang on a minute, I'm not standing here screaming. I appear to be chatting and having fun and doing some voices and telling some stories of show business. And so everyone in this room might be actually inside going, But and I think that moment of, and that's why some of the stand-up I'm doing at the moment, there's a bit that I'm in the current show where I met a woman out in Adelaide who told me one night to do material about suicide. Her daughter had killed herself, and so when I came back, this was just before I stopped doing stand-up, and when I came back for this show, I thought, I've got to write something about this. And it's a really interesting thing when I started to talk to people that I know who have reached that point in their life and, you know, then and then survived it, and people who've lost it. And that moment where you go, and I think some of the stuff that I like talking about on stage are the bits where I think, well, I'm allowed to be a fucking freak. I'm allowed to be, this is what I do. You know, I talk about the fact that when you get, you know, for a lot of people, if you get a weird idea, you go, oh, I better keep that one in. Because if I say that in the office, people are going to go, what the, you know. Whereas at stand-up, you know, you get a weird idea, you go, fucking hell, that's a weird idea. I wonder if that would work as a good 10. And you can do that. And that moment of being able to, you know, one of my favourite things that I talked about from was talking about impulsive thoughts, the fact that when you get a sense that you holding a baby and you imagine throwing the baby, you know, downstairs. And I would talk about the fact that that is not a desire. It's basically a public information film. Your brain in moments of jeopardy goes, you're holding a baby. Remember, don't throw it down the stairs. And the number of people that I would get coming up to me afterwards going, oh, God, I really genuinely thought that I wanted to. Because,
yeah.
And so we have got, you don't have to play this role. You can do stand up. I'm not saying that's how. But for certain times, you could be the person who says, you know, that really fucking weird thought that you would never tell anyone. It's fine. It's bubbling in all of us. And that is that moment of when, my favourite moment was when someone came up to me and went, I'm a bit annoyed. I came to your gig, I've always presumed I'm quite weird, and I've just sat in your audience watching your thing, and it turns out we're all fucking weird, so I'm normal. And, you know, and I think there's a genuine, it's that moment of, you know, we're all looking for a use, aren't we? And you go, yeah. Oh, that's good. That joke worked, and it was useful. It turns out it was pragmatic as well.
Peter Richardson says, I've noticed in his blogs he doesn't seem to believe in himself as a performer, despite being objectively pretty successful. Brackets, I think he's phenomenal, obviously. So the question is, what are your thoughts on your lack of self-confidence off stage?
I think it's and it is something that I think is in a later bit of the book, but the imposter syndrome is, I do find very often, especially at benefit gigs, and I look around and I go, real comic, real comic, real comic.
What is real comic, though, compared to what you are?
I know, it's a stupid... Again, it's the outside and the inside monologue, yeah. Isn't it? It's the difference. And I do still... I see myself as being this, you know, a lucky amateur who's been doing it the whole... And
that's, well, you've not been doing it long enough that everyone lets you in.
But it is what I do. And I know that, logically, my frontal lobes arguing with some shitty little lizard brain are going, look... Right, you make a living from this. You made a living from this for almost your whole adult life. People do turn up to see you, and look, everyone just laughs. And so it is that thing, isn't it, that you get that the night that they don't laugh is the night that the truth was seen.
Yeah, of course.
And the 270 night. I mean, that's why, you know, reviewers. I don't think in any way that I'm a critical darling, and I think that and it's not a problem, and it's, but it's an interesting thing where you just. Because I know that, and it's not as bad as it was. I just have to go, look, you do what you do, and some people really, and I should shut it up, because it's fucking so self-regarding as well. That's what annoys me. This, you just stop. It's tedious, and it's boring, and it's pointless. And so all I need to worry about is, have you delivered what you wanted to deliver? And has the delivering of that meant that some of those people, hopefully most of those people, have left and gone, that was fun? But so it's, and it is just, it's an imposter syndrome which starts from a very early age. And it's all the advantages, all the outsider advantages that make us what we are. It's like with Stephen Fry. Sometimes when I see something Stephen Fry thinks, I think Stephen Fry is the last person who should be doing what he does. And yet it's because he's that which he must do what he does. I mean, that's far, you know, he's gone through his bit, that bit where you just go, oh, Stephen, this worry of the, and yet you're also, you say yes to everything. You know, all of these different jobs, and every barb goes straight in there. And so but getting that balance right. And I think overall, I it's a lot more balanced now than it was 2.5 years ago.
A solution someone offered me for imposter syndrome is to think, recognise it's happening again, smile in congratulation that you've recognised it, and then, if all else fails, remember your values. You can think to yourself, I may not be the funniest person on this bill, but I do love comedy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm valid. I've got a right to be here because I love the thing itself. I don't need to be the funniest That's person good. In the room. I would add that. I would also add personally that plenty of people who are critical darlings can't get an audience.
Yeah.
You know, as we know, as touring acts, there's plenty of people who have phenomenal reviews, but it's not the same thing as pulling power, you know, the ability to actually perform to people. So, anyway, can you do an impression of Michael Legg?
I can't really do Michael, actually. It's really... what I can do is when Michael has said to me... I've said, Michael, let's do a Vitriola podcast on Tuesday. And he'll go, yeah, mate, yeah, that's great. And then I ring him up and I go, where are we meeting tonight? And he goes, oh, the Blue Posts. And I go, are we doing Vitriola? He goes, no. And I turn up and I go, Michael, what... I thought we were doing... And he immediately goes... He goes, no, that's not what he said. No. And he turns into this and I go, yes, you did. No, you did not. I can't do the voice. I can only do the aggression.
That was a pretty horrifyingly accurate.
I like to turn him into, Don Logan.
Don Logan, yeah.
That's one of the things that I missed most. In one of the routines that I got rid of very early on the tour, my favourite bit was talking about once when my agent rang me up and all I did back to her when I turned down a job with Katie Hopkins was doing Don Logan going, No way. Oh, God, I love doing that.
That was a question from Christian Thompson. The next question is from Michael, I believe Forster, but I didn't make a note of it. Is Ricky Gervais more annoying than Brian Cox's good looking?
Oh, it's difficult because I don't... See, Brian, I feel, has something of the android about him. And it's hard to... Ricky's not, because now he's entered that, you know, middle age stage of being a little... He still will get overly excited and make weird noises at me, but he hasn't got the energy to keep it up. So, whereas Brian's good looks, of course, have not faded. Ricky's energy to annoy is at a lower ebb.
Oh, I wish he and everyone listening to this could see the smile in your eyes.
I'll tell you what, that was the joy of him becoming famous. The joy of him becoming famous was sometimes we'd be walking down the street and he would start to do something to annoy me and then someone would go, oh, mate, do the dance.
Yes.
And he'd go, fuck, get out of here. You know, and that was great. I used to love that.
At which point you cuff him to a lamppost and scarf.
Make him do the dance, everyone. Go on.
Well, David Duncan asks, early career at the Fringe, upstairs at the Cafe Royal, which I assume is Robert Eckert. Could you tell who would make it as comics, who wouldn't, and who would do something different? What are your instincts at the time for like going, oh, they're going places?
Do you know what? There's a different thing. This is what's odd, is that go back 20 years and one comic a year would get to the next stage of being a theatre act. So it's only really in the last 12 years that suddenly... there's this huge swathe of people becoming arena acts. So I was never a good judge on who would last on the circuit. Because there were certain acts you used to think, oh, they're not very good. And then suddenly they become, you know, on the circuit the whole time.
Immediately name them. No, I'm joking. But I
don't think, you know, there's lots of people that I really love watching who I think should be. I mean, I do think, you know, Josie is, of course, critically revered, but Josie I still don't think has had the proper opportunity she should. I mean, she does this wonderful show on Radio 4 and stuff, and she's Shortcuts. But, you know, she's someone who has that, when we talk about critical darlings, that strange mix of the fact that because she's properly idiosyncratic in what she does, she can't be boxed for immediate. And then people, you know, there's people like kind of. I'll tell you someone who I want to mention actually, people who I think should be much better. Joanna Neary, who I've worked with on many occasions. And she is one of those people that instinctually I believe that anyone in television and anyone in radio would be going, oh my God, what can we do with her? She's so fantastic. And the fact that hasn't happened. I think, you know, my judgment of people who are brilliant, I think, is excellent. My judgment of what people in the media think is brilliant is very poor. And so I think Joe Neary is someone who I really think should have her own show. And it's, again, it's joyous. You know, when you watch someone, it's like I remember the first time watching John Hegley and going, oh, it doesn't even matter about the words. So the words are, of course, magnificent. There's something just so beautiful and funny about, you know, there's certain, so I think I don't think in that way very much. I don't imagine who's gonna, once I just love something, I hope that they have a huge amount of success, but I'm not, in terms of talent scouting.
John Hegley was a huge... I am a huge fan of John Hegley, and I remember I used to be, as a kid, I remember really kind of discovering John Hegley and being so excited about him.
I still do. I have to admit, every now and again when I'm on the bill with John at a benefit or something like that, and I can rarely resist... doing Eddie Don't Go
Eddie,
those funny little tables that you have to buy in threes. The closest thing that Ed's got to piece of furniture is the cheese board. Eddie doesn't bolster the upholstery biz. There's a lot of furniture in the world, but none of it's Eddie's. I remember watching him on an Edinburgh Fringe, you know, when they always used to be filmed in some dank little room. There would be three BBC Two shows, and it must have been about 1987. And it was when, and John does that lovely bit where he'll go, just to find out the audience now, so this is section A, this is section B, and you, sir, are section C. And he would do that whole bit where he goes, so I go, Eddie don't like furniture, and you go, na-na-na, na-na. Go, Eddie don't like furniture, and you go, na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And then he would go, and you, sir, you go, and he did this huge bit, and then he just looked straight down the barrel of the camera and go, and why not try this at home? And it was just the way he did it. There's I remember watching him once where someone arrived late for his show. It was at the Assembly Rooms in Edinburgh, must have been about 1989, 1990, and they just walked in and he said nothing, and he just was silent, and he watched them all the way to the seat and then just went late. And it's, yeah, that lovely, that teaching lovely equality. Yeah,
having just inaccurately joined in with that rhyme of Eddie Don't Like Furniture, I have to point out, what is it? He once got on a rowing boat, they offered him a seat. It was just a strip of timber, but it wasn't up his street. So Eddie stood up in the boat to make himself feel steady. He threw the plank onto the bank and said, furniture, no thank you. I suddenly felt like a terribly bad fan because I joined in wrong.
Great.
Oh, dear. He's absolutely wonderful. Right, this is offered by Phil Minns with absolutely no apologies for the terribly worthy and serious question. At the moment, there's a lot of talk floating around the internet about, great start, about how the sceptical community / online atheists / new atheists has begun to be co-opted by the right, who try to frame feminism and social justice as irrational or just emotional. Has Robin noticed any backlash in his comedy and scepticism circles against the recent rise in awareness, for want of a better term, of social issues? And if so, does he think comedy can express sufficient nuance to address it?
I think I've certainly, I mean, over the years recently in particular, I've kind of not become distant from scepticism, but I think organised, I'm always slightly worried about, you know, there was a few years ago where I started to get worried about some of the conferences that I was asked to go to. And
okay, I think, worried how?
Well, I found that some of the issues being talked about, some of the way that religion was being talked about, you know, I'm not atheism. In an odd way, it defines me very little. It used to be
kind of part of your brand in a weird way.
Yeah, but I think because I did Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People that only came out of arguing with Stephen Green from Christian Voice and decided to do a really joyous Christmas show.
Yeah.
Which the angle was, it was, you know, why do people with belief have all the fun? We're going to have fun without it.
Sure.
Very quickly, people came from, you know, religious people turned up and it was fine. And in fact, I've now changed, I had a bit of a break from it and it's come back and we're now calling it Nine Lessons Carols for Curious People.
Great.
Because
great.
I think that it came out of a joke from a long time ago. And in fact, even this year when we brought it back after a few years and I came out at the beginning, I said, I just want to explain the title. And the I said, it doesn't matter if you believe in a God, I don't care about it. It's literally, you know, and the point is, all I care about is, you know, whatever you believe. You know, I can't remember the exact words I used, but it's like, you know, the main things I care about are kindness and decency towards human beings. And I said, and as we know, you know, there's a lot of atheists as well who, having no God, doesn't stop me being an arsehole. And in fact, in some ways, that's the bit that's made me a bit depressed. And the whole audience were with that, you know.
Sure.
And then the bit that makes me a bit depressed is sometimes when I do see some of the, you know, the brutishness, which is meant to come from this enlightenment, I think, oh my God, you know, I understand when people have somehow fallen into a trap of believing that an angry deity is going to destroy them unless they're cruel to those who've been considered to be the outsiders. But when you haven't even got a God to make you an arsehole and you voluntarily, of your own free will, should free will exist. you know, I was interesting, I was meant to be doing a conference out in Australia that just had a really interesting bill, and it was for an atheist group, and quite early on, I thought, I don't think this is going to happen. Because something that's happened in atheism, which I think is interesting, is about 11, 12 years ago, I think there was a moment where people went, oh, you don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. We must have loads in common. And then over the ensuing 10 years, we've gone, the deity issue, man. So, you know, I'm friends with quite a few people who are, well, you know, professionals in the world of faith. And I have lovely conversations with them, people who are vicars and bishops and all manner of things. And I don't, and more, I mean, even at the time, I had some jokes about religion, but I was always very, I'd try and be very specific. I think anyone who just goes, oh, people only believe in God because they want an afterlife, doesn't know the complexity of it. You know, there's a friend of mine who is high up in the church, but he believes in all of the, you know, the science, etc. He's fine with Big Bang Theory and evolutionary biology and all of that. And I think it's an interesting thing to know that, you know, that God and those beliefs sits in a different part of the head for some people, not for everyone. You know, and so I remember talking to Richard Dawkins once and saying, the problem with, just to me, anti-religion doesn't mean very much. It's anti-dogmatism. And, you know, dogma is that, so whether it's Stalinism, or whether it's extremist evangelical Christianity, whatever it might be, you know, that's the bit. Extremism is the battle. And the idea that should we eventually go, oh, God's left, there's no God, it's fine. You won't then go, everyone going, oh, now there's no God. All I want to do is care and be kind. You know, that one, because we're drawn towards dogmatism. But there was this thing where there's a feminist and, oh, man, I'm going to be Clementine Ford, who's an Australian feminist, who's written a book called Fight Like a Girl. And when she was announced on this conference, I started getting things from men's rights activists going, you do know that she says kill all men. And I went, I've kind of checked on this, and it does very much seem like this is... it's kind of meant in a very jokey way, and also with the power structures of society, etc. I think we can see how this joke works, and blah, blah, blah. No, she says kill all men, I can't believe you're going to be share a stage with her. I went, I don't have an issue with her, and I think it's a joke. And at that point, I thought, seeing things like this make me realise they're not going to get enough people to come to this conference anymore, because 10 years ago they'd have got them, but now they go, everyone's fragmented. And it turns out those other ideologies. And I said to one of the people, I said, look, if she does mean kill all men, she's been very lazy. She hasn't killed her husband, she hasn't killed her son. And should, when I walk on stage, she immediately kill me, you can go. And we warned him. We said, you know, but yeah, so it's an interesting, so I don't feel, I think in the end, I try and distance myself as much as possible from things that can end up being dogmatic. And I would like to have as many open conversations with as many people as possible.
And well, what strikes me there is the fact that you bothered to reply. Do you know what I mean? That you were prepared to have a conversation with that person, which I... perhaps not to their satisfaction.
It's hard sometimes, because it's like with flat earthers and stuff and moon hoaxers. And I try to understand when they get in contact, because there's no point in arguing, because they've already decided not to believe in evidence and they don't believe that human beings are being in space and all those things. But I'm interested in knowing why people believe what they believe. Yeah. But then there's a point where I think, oh, I'm about to tell them to fuck off, so I now have to just stop. Because I don't want... And at that, I've not always managed to stop before that moment. But there's a little bit where your brain just goes, I just can't understand anymore how you can't believe that people have stood on the moon and you can't believe that, you know, Tim Peake and Chris Hadfield have been into space and all of those things.
How's this for a wrap-up? I now have to tell you to fuck off.
Great.
We've run out of time.
Great.
Two incredibly quick questions.
Yes.
What would you have written on your comedy gravestone?
See, even now, I wonder if when it gets to the comedy cemetery, there will be people who go, I don't think he can go in. I don't think he was, you know, so there'll be... I think that, you know, the imposter syndrome would be within my zombie mind.
Final question. Are you happy?
I think so, but as Max Wall said, and I love Max Wall, his book Fool on the Hill is a very interesting comedy autobiography. You know, happy is a very, it's a transient thing. It's like, you know, am I content? I think overall I am. Did I wake up this morning and did I spend an hour feeling quite miserable about what I was trying to achieve and worried about things? Yes. Am I happy now sitting opposite you? Yes. Was I happy when I was in the Oxfam bookshop 2 hours ago and found a book that I really want to read? Yes. And there might be a moment when I'm sitting on the train on the way back and I go, Jesus Christ, what was I talking about with Stuart Goldsmith? I imagine there'll now be loads of people on the internet saying, what an arsehole, and why did you have him on? And then I'll be reading Tales from the Crypt with my son later on tonight, because he's really into those comics at the moment, and I'll be happy again. And then I go to sleep and I might be worried.
Oh, what a shame there was that last sentence on the end. Thanks, Robin.
So that was Robin. Thank you so much to Robin for coming along. There are bundles more stuff to talk about with Robin at the Insiders Club on the private podcast, which is easy to sign up to for £2 a month or more if you fancy, at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You can get hold of extra content from Robin Ince, Dara O'Brien, Anuvab Pal, Russell Howard, Sarah Millican, and plenty of other people besides, as well as all of these extra projects. Now, I'm going to do a quick... I'll talk to you, and if you're... if you fancy listening, I'll talk to you about these in the post-amble. But for now, thank you to Robin. Thanks to Paul Sullivan for helping to set up that interview. Thanks to Nathan Wood for producing and editing the show. And thank you to everyone at Angel Comedy, the Bill Murray. Next week, maybe John Luke Roberts. Oh, it's a blinder. Maybe Raymond and Timkins. Maybe I'll wedge them both out one after another. Let's find out. That concludes the podcast for today. But if you'd like to hang around for the post-amble, please do. So, God, what a great mood I'm in just recalling this conversation. I really enjoyed this podcast so much. Let me try to remember the things I said I'd talk about in this bit. Doing nice things to people and never mentioning it to anyone. Have I spoken about that in a previous post-amble? It's from a John Ronson book. He was trying to, or an article where he spoke to a billionaire and said, "What's the secret of happiness?" And the guy didn't want to give it away for reasons that would come clear. But what he said was that you need to do nice things for people and then never tell them. And every time you tell someone about a nice thing you've done, it deletes it from your balance sheet and means that you can no longer feel happy about it inside. So you have to just continually do nice things and never talk about it. What a great idea. Look up some of the work of the fabulous John Ronson if you'd like to find out where to find out more about that or find the article. I can't tell you. I don't know where it was, but I remember it was in something with the excellent John Ronson. So there's that. And I'd like to say a really big thank you as well to Stuart Laws from Turtle Canyon and Ed Moore, who you may know as a comedy photographer, Ed Strong at Chucklebusters Comedy in Bristol, and also to Vishay and Josh, who came along working with Stu, who did the DVD record for me last night at the Wardrobe Theatre in Bristol, which was jam-packed with people. I was trying to decide beforehand what I wanted to do with the... I paid for it all out of podcast funds. Thank you, everyone. And it cost quite a lot of money to get it proper. You know, given that these days you could get two people with a phone to make like a passable thing. I didn't want it to be passable. I wanted it to be extraordinary. So that's why I got in touch with Purple Canyon. Did I just call you Purple Canyon twice? Turtle Canyon is what I mean. That's why I got in touch with Stuart and Turtle Canyon, who recently done James Acaster's Netflix recordings and all sorts of excellent things like that. I wanted it to be really excellent, and I didn't know. I just thought I wanted to buy the thing myself so I own it, so that if I want to, I can give it away in comedy online releases and kind of taping shows at the moment. A few people offer some version of a thing where they tape it for you, but then you can't give it away because they want to sell it to make their money back. Of course, it's a very smart way of doing it. I wanted to own it, and all week I've been thinking, was this a sensible idea? Is this just a huge use of resources for something that I don't have a clear plan about? It was so much fun. Thank you if you're one of the 100 or so people that came along. It was so, so much fun. And I did a warm-up thing. I was kind of being the warm-up and the floor manager and the act. So I came out and did a warm-up bit, which we taped all of that off. And that was really fun. There's some nice crowd-worky stuff there as well. And then there are some bits where I tripped up and laughed and fell over. I felt like I was doing Bottom Live. It was so much fun to have lots of really fun mistakes in the room. And then there was a bit where the sound went wrong. It broke for 10 minutes. The mic went down. So I'm on stage normally in the recording of something. You go, quick, get the warm-up back on. That was me. So I stayed on and did a load of stuff. I told the beekeeper's joke. We had a bit of a muck about. There were some phenomenal heckles. I'm not a fan of hecklers. But if you've seen me live, you may have seen me refer to the fact that I seem to be cultivating incredibly nice audiences who offer worthwhile, positive and very funny heckles. So there were a few of them. And look, I'm not opening the door here. Don't heckle ever. But on this occasion, it was fine. And basically, then we went in, we finished the show, went back into it, finished everything up. And I realised I'd solved that question for myself. What do I do with the extra stuff? What I'm planning to do now is give away the clean edit of the show, maybe 55 to an hour, I'm going to give that away. I'm going to launch it bigly on YouTube. And when I do that, I'll talk to you about it nearer the time. And I would like everyone to jump on that and try and help me make it visible, because, you know, that's how you've got to do it these days. And I can rely on you guys, I know. So I'm going to release the clean version for free. You can all have the clean version for free. I'll almost certainly put the audio on the podcast as well. Unless doing that sends fewer people to YouTube. No, probably I'll do it YouTube first to direct everyone there. And then I'm going to make available to people of yourselves, fans, listeners, who fancy buying it as a special edition. I'm going to release the whole, almost unedited. There's one or two boring mistakes. We'll probably get rid of them, but we'll leave in all the fun mistakes, and there's tons of them. It's probably like a 90-minute show with the warm-up and everything, so I might release a special edition for purchase. So you can support me by watching it on YouTube and enjoy it, and then you can get even more enjoyment out of it and support me in a more financial way by buying the big, long version of it. I think that is such a good piece of content. Don't say content. It's just a piece of stuff. It's like a real marker for me. I've enjoyed the tour so much. There's 6 performances left, I think, and that's it. And then it's gone forever. And I this is the show I've done most. It'll be 90-odd times by the end of it. So I really am so thrilled that we got a nice clean version. I'm sweating a little bit because I didn't think to hire a makeup person or someone to run on and dab me. But that would have been good. I'm assured it's not a problem, but I felt very self-conscious. It will be released soon, I think before Edinburgh. I hope before Edinburgh. It'd be good to get it out in July. And I will talk to you nearer the time about whamming a load of views up it. I don't know the terminology. Sounds about right. So that's that. Thank you very much to Robin. I've done all these the thank yous and everything, but thanks. Thank you to everyone that came to that and everyone that was involved in it, and thank you to my wife for being incredibly supportive when I got back very, very tired, having had 3 hours sleep after my Glasgow show and being all keyed up about the forthcoming DVD thing. And some absolutely sensational co-parenting was done to enable me to get my shit together and give of my best. That siren in the background means they're coming for me. I'm going to go. Thank you for listening. I'll speak to you soon.